Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
To start off, I want to note, and this will be less striking to those of you who have not read Aristotle's famous work, The Nicomachean Ethics, but those of you who have, you are sometimes struck by something when you read it, which is Aristotle is a huge fan of two things in particular, friendship and contemplation. For Aristotle, these two things, they're just the bee's knees, as I take it the youth at one point said. And he doesn't just think they're like amongst many great things, right? He treats them as incredibly central to our understanding of what would make a life meaningful. I've got two passages here just at the top of the handout. They're two of many I could have chosen from this book, but they're sort of representative. So looking at that first one, when he talks about friendship a little earlier, he says, after that, after he talks about a whole bunch of complications about the nature of virtue, the next topic is virtue, is friendship. For it is a virtue or involves virtue. And this is the really interesting line. Further, it is most necessary for our life, for no one would choose to live without friends. And this English translation is a little ambiguous, but if you look at the Greek, what he says is, if you didn't have friends, you would not choose to live. Aristotle, I'm like 95% sure that's true. I've looked at the Greek, I'm not that good at Greek, but my friend who also knows Greek much better than me says I'm right about that. Right? What he's saying here is, if you didn't have friends, you would not choose to live. He's not saying, if you had two choices, a life with friends, a life without friends, you'd choose a life with friends. Well, yeah, that's true. But he's saying, if it was a choice between a life with friends or not a life, a life without friends and not a life. You wouldn't have good reason to choose the life without friends. Friendship for him seems to be central to making life worth living. At least he seems to say this in this passage. And that's striking. That's really high praise because you don't see him use similar language like that about any of the other things he's a big fan of. He really likes virtues like courage and justice. But he doesn't ever seem to suggest that like if you're a coward, life just isn't worth living at that point. He doesn't go that far, even when he is a big fan of things like courage. Similarly for contemplation, right? He ends up placing contemplation even higher than friendship, right? So first he's like, friendship, without that, life's not worth living, and contemplation is even better. He has a passage, this is from the very last book of the Nicomachean Ethics. He says, complete happiness will be its activity in accord with its proper virtue, and it has been said that this activity is an activity of contemplation. For it is properly of each thing's nature is supremely best and pleasant at first. And hence for a human being, the life of contemplation will be supremely best and pleasantest. And it's, you know, sometimes you really think like, I mean, sure, Aristotle, right? Like the famous philosopher, you think that the life of contemplation, a philosophical truth, is the pleasantest life. And you know, there's two things you can interpret from this. One, maybe contemplation has a lot more going for it than we realize. Or two, maybe Aristotle had a lot less going for him than we might otherwise think, right? You know, and I don't think we should rule out the hypothesis Aristotle just needed to get a life. It's very, very possible that that's the proper thing to interpret here. And in fact, I'm at the end of this talk going to make an argument along those lines to a certain extent. But for now, right, we should take it seriously if someone who's as significant in the history of philosophy as Aristotle says that these two things are really special. And it raises two questions, at least it raised two questions for me. Because I never really got the book, right, The Nicomachean Ethics. I got like individual pieces of it, but I didn't understand why after like all this discussion of virtue and courage and justice and how we live with one another and health and all this stuff, and there's like friendship and contemplation. I mean, like, those seem like great things, but why did it all build up to that? And so the first version of this question, the one that, you know, really bothered me for years when I would read and even teach this book, was the question, why are these two things privileged above any of the other great things that a human life could be characterized by? Things like skillful activity, right? Really excellent, you know, athletic activity, or playing chess really well. Political governance, right? Aristotle thinks humans are political creatures more so than even bees, right? So why is like not like political leadership up here? Wealth, courage, justice, children, nachos are great, right? And yet he doesn't show up, not, you know, sure he didn't know about them, but like he was a smart guy, he could have figured it out. But he didn't seem to think it was that important, right? Here he goes inventing logic and metaphysics and not nachos? I don't know. producing beautiful art, time spent in nature, wonderful stories, right? Like, we're narrative creatures. You know, it's not like he didn't know this, right? He was a student of Plato who thought that, like, the stories we tell children are fundamentally shape our character. And yet we don't hear that show up on this list. So take whatever the great things you think are out there, and maybe you think contemplation and pleasure, contemplation and friendship are amongst those great things. That's a totally intelligible thing. But why would you not just place them amongst a large list of great things? What gives them this kind of preeminence over everything else? That's the first question. And the second question that really bothered me is, why are there two things that get this preeminent treatment? Two is such a weird number, right, in philosophy. Things don't usually come in groups of two, right? Sometimes you have one, like the one principle that explains everything. You very often get threes, right? You get threes all over the place. In Aristotle, right, obviously Christians love three because of the Trinity, right? So they always try to make everything come down to threes. The philosopher C.S. Peirce has basically an entire book in which he just argues that everything comes down to threes because people kept accusing him of just, like, having an irrational love of the number of sorting things into groups of threes. So he had to, like, write a whole book saying, no, it wasn't irrational. So, like, if it was three, I get it. If it was four, I get it. But, like, two is not a super common, it doesn't show up that often in philosophy, unless you're dealing with opposites. Light, dark. Truth, falsehood. When you're dealing with that kind of thing, you start to see twos all over the place in philosophy. But when you're not dealing with a dyad of that sort, it's just really weird to have things come into groups of two. So, you know, these questions bothered me, and I would teach this book, and I never had an answer to this question. And now I'm going to try in this talk to give an answer to this question. And it's not an answer you directly get from reading Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. But to some extent, I think if we take Aristotle seriously, that shouldn't bother us. Because Aristotle's ethics is supposed to be not some abstract unpacking of his own intellectual thought. It's instead supposed to be insight into the condition that human beings have just as such. Aristotle, when he explains the method he takes in ethics, says he starts not with his own philosophical preoccupations. He thinks this is what Plato did, right? Plato start with his own philosophical theory of forms and stuff like that and try to do his ethical theory in light of that. And he says, no, we start with the ordinary paradoxes and complexities and puzzles that seem to face the wise people around us who struggle with understanding what makes a life good, and we want to test our theories by seeing if it makes good sense of those puzzles. And so, applying Aristotle, what we should do is not just address his arguments, we want to take the puzzles that sort of preoccupy us today and figure out, does Aristotle's claims about ethics help us make sense of them? And here, I want to take one puzzle that's bothered me for a long time, and it's a certain kind of argument for nihilism, or something along the lines of human life really isn't that important. It's not very meaningful, right? It's fine, but that's as much as it is. And here's the argument, right? It is developed on the top of page 2 of the handout. It starts with the following sort of basic dilemma. First, it says human actions can be divided up into two types, work and play. And we can actually see why these are sort of exhaustive options. That's because you would only take an action if there was some difference you were trying to make. Either things are currently bad and you want to make them better, or things are good, but they're going to get worse unless you take action, so you need to stop that from happening. But if you have reason to do something rather than nothing, there must be some problem, some obstacle, some difference you are trying to make. And so if action is always aimed at a difference, well, then there's two options. Either the action occurs because of the difference we're trying to make, or we're trying to make a difference because of the action we want to do. And these are just what we mean by work and play. So let's take the first half of this. Work is that state where the activity exists because it's a problem. Someone's sick. We want them to be healthy. So a doctor goes and does their work. We're hungry. We don't want to be hungry. So we go to the store and buy food. We need money to go to the store to buy food. We don't have money. So we go to a job to get paid. In work, there is some problem that we want to overcome, or there will be some problem if we don't take preventative action. Or we're worried a problem might arise, or some probability a problem will arise if we don't do something. But in each case, we have the activity because the problem exists. This is what's characteristic of things we classify as work. Play is basically the opposite. In play, you're still trying to do something, but you're trying to do something for the sake of the activity. So let's take the example of running a race. You know, me and my friend are running a race. We're both trying to get to the finish line. And so I say, well, easy. I just go get in my car and drive over to the finish line. Well, no, you're not supposed, you're supposed to get there by running. Why? That sounds like so much more work. Well, not because there's anything good about getting to the finish line via running. Instead, we require you to get to the finish line via running so that we can have the activity of running a race. Or take the game of chess. In chess, you're trying to get the pieces on the board arranged in particular types of patterns in which your opponent has no move they can make that allows the king not to be taken the next turn. This is a very random thing that you could want to do with these chess pieces, right? Another very random thing you could do, you could want to get all of your chess pieces into triangles on the board. Another totally random thing. Why do you do one rather than the other? Well, we do one just because we think it makes for a better game, right? We don't try, it's not like we play chess in order to checkmate our opponents. Rather, we checkmate our opponents in order to play chess. The problem that my opponent's pieces are not checkmated exists so that I can engage in that activity. The nature of play is where you basically manufacture a problem in order to be able to undertake an activity because you want the activity. The nature of work is you undertake an activity because you face some problem. But if all activities are organized around a problem, then it seems like all activity is going to be either a form of work, broadly conceived, or a form of play, broadly conceived. And some things straddle the difference here. So take, for example, my sister-in-law, who really likes woodworking. And so she will make really nice cutting boards out of wood via like all the tools she has and things of this sort. Now here, there's a problem. She needs a cutting board, or she needs a gift to buy, like, you know, send someone a cutting board as a present or things like this. But of course, it'd be way easier and indeed cheaper for her to just buy a nice cutting board off Etsy or things like this. Okay? Why does she not do so? Because she wants to be able to undertake the activity of making the cutting board. She enjoys the activity of woodworking. And so here, there is a sort of element of work, right? She actually does need a present. But and so she undertakes the activity of making the cutting board. But the reason she undertakes the activity of making the cutting board rather than buying the cutting board off Etsy is not because it's cheaper, it's not, but because she enjoys the activity. So there's elements of both work and play here. But each of these individual elements can still be analytically decomposed into an element that's either work or play. And so if we accept this, if we accept all of our actions are either work or play, now we want to figure out which one of these makes life meaningful. And the problem is neither seem like a good fit to explain the meaning of human life. So let's start with work. Why does work seem like a bad explanation of the value of human activity? Well, a couple reasons, but here's one straightforward one. Work aims at its own elimination. The nature of work is to eliminate the need for that work. If you're an NGO trying to stamp out malaria, then your ultimate success would be if you stamp out malaria. But of course, once you stamp out malaria, there's no more work for your anti-malaria organization to do. Every NGO should, at their heart, be trying to put themselves out of business. Take doctors. Doctors try to cure the sick. Of course, usually if you cure the sick, the person just gets sick again later, right? Or you cure the toddler, in which case the toddler gets sick a day later. But regardless, I have toddlers at home right now, and it's fall. So, you know, this preoccupation of mine. But the best doctor, like the world's greatest medical researcher, wouldn't just find some cure for disease. They'd like invent a pill that permanently cures all diseases. If someone did that, it'd be the greatest work of medicine ever, if they could somehow manage pull this off. But of course, in doing so, they would eliminate the need for there ever to be doctors again. The greatest act of medicine would be an act that eliminates the need for medicine. And it would eliminate a whole bunch of other jobs as well, like grave robbing. So what we have is that the nature of work aims at the elimination of work. But it just sounds wrong to say that like meaningful human life aims at the elimination of the meaning of human life. So if work is what gives life meaning, and the nature of work is to aim at the elimination of work, then it starts to sound like the meaning of human life is to make human life meaningless. But that doesn't sound like a good account. Second problem here, it seems to get things in some sense backwards. Because it seems like the only reason we do work is because we think the lives that we make possible by that work were independently worth living. So suppose I'm a doctor and I cure a person. Can it really be plausible that I cure them for the sake of me doctoring? It doesn't seem so, because of course if that's true, why am I curing them rather than killing them? Both of those would be activities I could do using my medical knowledge. Well, I cure them because I think their life will be worth living. The reason why it's a meaningful work to be a doctor is precisely because you are making the world better by allowing people to go live these meaningful lives. Aristotle and Plato both give examples like this where they talk about how, you know, we praise ship captains for getting people safely across seas and storms only because we think it's good that those people survive. The way Aristotle puts this later on in the Nicomachean Ethics, he says, leisure is the end. He says, happiness seems to be found in leisure, but we deny ourselves leisure so that we can be at leisure. We work so that we can have leisure and fight wars so that we can be at peace. You'll sometimes hear people say, like, I work for the weekends. And there's something philosophically astute in this insight, which is that if the work exists merely to solve the problem, well, all that solving the problem is going to get you is away from a negative back to something neutral, unless it's just that neutral thing is itself good. And so it seems as though unless human lives were independently valuable, the work we do to keep human lives going would not have value. So it seems like we want to find something outside of work to explain the value of human life and activity. A third problem, work seems parasitic on at least some sort of privation or badness. Why do we have doctors? Because there's sickness and death. Why do we have farmers? Because there's not enough food for everyone to just be able to like get, you know, automatically by reaching out and like finding grapes or things like this. And this is why when we think about like various visions of utopia, they seem to, a central element is eliminating the need to work. You can see this in religious doctrines, right? It doesn't seem like we're doing work in the new creation in the same way that we are now, right? There's no longer need for doctors or farmers or things of this sort. And similarly, when people talk about utopia these days, there's often sort of emphasis on like computers, automation, taking over the drudgery of work to allow people to go off and do their own thing. This is some of the more beautiful passages you'll find in the works of Karl Marx, is when he talks about the way in which we actually need to move through a capitalist system in order to increase the productive power of a society, precisely so that people can spend less of their life in the drudgery of work and more in the leisure of, you know, producing great musical art or sophisticated intellectual understanding or contemplating philosophy or things like this. It seems like when we take our sort of pictures of utopia, they eliminate all those bad things that work was designed to ameliorate. But it doesn't sound right to say that, well, human life would be meaningless in utopia. And so it doesn't quite sound right to say that the meaning of human life is found in work. There are, of course, some other problems you could bring up as well, right? You might worry what this has, like the implications this has for people with, you know, serious disabilities who aren't able to work, things like that. But we could add on more arguments of this sort. But for now, I think we've got some fairly compelling reasons to think that whatever the value of human life, it's not found in work. Well, that only leaves us one option. It's found in play. The problem, however, is that we seem to not be very satisfied with that story either. So, a couple of objections. First one, play seems to be characterized by a troubling kind of frivolity. So take the person who went from being a great neurosurgeon, who was saving lives every week, doing complicated surgeries no one else could do, and they retire, and they take up much more seriously their golf game. What you will often find in this is that people tend to sort of deteriorate quite quickly because they don't find the same kind of meaning or significance in what they're doing now because there's a kind of frivolity to these things that they're doing just for the sake of the activity. This is borne out in lots of studies about retirement where people who had jobs they really considered meaningful tend to actually like struggle a lot once they enter periods of retirement. Second problem with this, it seems in some sense that like leisure just strictly has to have less work or less value than work, because pretty much anything you could do as leisure, you could also do as work. And at least work, you get the activity plus you get the product that you have at the end. Like this little comic that's on the handout, right, that sort of illustrates the phenomenon. You can play a video game. You can also be a video game playtester, right? if the activity of like video game playing, or like excellence in video game playing, were itself so valuable in some way, then you'd think that the work of doing this would just be better, because you not only get the activity of excellent, skillful play, but you would also get the product of like creating great games for other people to be able to do. And so it seems like if the meaningfulness of work is not enough, leisure is just going to be sort of strictly less meaningful. The meaning, in a sense, and this brings us to the third point, of leisure, it has a kind of surfaceness to it, where the activity has no value beyond just the activity. It's all sort of born up in our own need to be doing something. But it starts to feel kind of very cramped to think that there's nothing more significant about your activity than your own activity. That your activity is just all there is ultimately to it, and it's just about you doing something you find enjoyable or skillful or things like that. When all you have is play, it feels like you kind of get shut up inside your own leisure. And so this is, I think, an actually pretty significant puzzle. What sort of activity is it that makes our life meaningful? And to solve it, I think we have to use two Aristotelian sort of insights. So now we're on the top of page 3. Hopefully we can move through this next bit a little faster since we have this sort of foundation in place. But I want to introduce a distinction that's actually not in the Nicomachean Ethics. It comes in one of Aristotle's later books, The Metaphysics. It's unclear if he had the distinction in mind when he wrote the Nicomachean Ethics, but I certainly think it sort of illuminates what it is he's doing here, so I'm going to bring it in anyway. And he introduced a distinction between two types of activities, kinesis on the one hand, or what is sometimes called finite activities, and energeia, or what is sometimes called infinite activities. And we can see this contrast in two ways, but let me start with some examples. If you actually look at the second row of this, central examples of kinesis, things like playing a game of chess, crossing the street, getting your kids into a good school, building a house. Note that in each of these, there is some point at which the activity becomes complete. So when you are crossing a street, there is some point at which you have crossed the street. And when you are playing a game of chess, there's some point at which you have played the game of chess. When you're trying to get your kids into a good school, there's some point at which you've gotten your kids into a good school. And at that point, the activity is over. So here we have an activity that has a completion that is in some sense outside the activity, because once the completion occurs, the activity is done. But of course, we have other descriptions of activities that don't work this way. Seeing, walking, friendship, and indeed some that are the same, like playing chess. Me and my friend can be playing chess, and we finish one game and just start playing another one, and another one, and another one. And here we're just playing chess the whole time, and there's no point at which there's some like natural completion point for when, okay, that was 4 games, that's the end of playing chess. Well, no, we could keep going if we want to. So in kinesis, the activity, so long as it's ongoing, remains incomplete. It is complete only once it reaches an endpoint. Whereas in energeia, the activity is complete in itself at every moment. We can make this point perhaps more clearly if we look at the third part of this table, which is the logic of aspectual sentences. You'll all be familiar with tense, right? This is pretty common, past tense, future tense, present tense. But there's another aspect, called aspect, to our use of verbs in language. And these are things like perfective versus imperfective aspect. So here are two sentences, both in past tense, but one has perfective aspect and one has imperfective aspect. I was crossing the street. I had crossed the street. Both describe something that occurred in the past, but one describes it as complete, the other describes it as ongoing. I was crossing the street uses imperfective aspect. It describes the past action as ongoing. I had crossed the street describes the past action as completed. Now, a chief test of something is kinesis is that the perfective and progressive aspect, or the perfective and imperfective aspect, exclude one another. If I am crossing a street, I've not yet crossed the street. If I have crossed the street, I'm no longer crossing the street. It has to be one or the other, because once the completion occurs, the activity is done. Whereas when you're dealing with energeia, if it is ongoing at all, it's already occurred. If I am playing chess, I've played chess, though perhaps not very long. If I am being a friend, I've been a friend, though perhaps only for a few seconds. If I'm going on a walk, if I'm walking, I've walked. Not very long, perhaps. But the moment I've done it at all, I've done it. The moment I'm doing it all, I've already done it at least for like half a millisecond or whatever. And so here we have the sort of grammatical difference between these two types of activities, which shows why one and the same activity can be one or the other, depending on how it's, you know, especially constructed. So playing a game of chess, if you were playing a game of chess, you've not yet played that game of chess. Once you've played the game of chess, you're no longer playing it. You can be playing a new one, but it won't be that same activity anymore. In contrast, if me and my friends have been playing chess, then we can still be playing chess. We've played chess, we're still playing chess. All that one activity can be ongoing and continuous. And so we get this difference that we can only understand the activity by having its end in view when we have kinesis, but that's not the case for energeia. If you don't know how a game of chess comes to an end, you can't be playing chess. If you don't know that crossing the street ends when you get across the street, you're not crossing the street intentionally, right? You have to know, to cross the street intentionally, you have to know what it is for the crossing the street to stop. It's essential to understand the activity, to understand the endpoint of the activity when it's kinesis. But that's totally not true for energeia. There need not be any conceptual endpoint. If me and my friends have had a great friendship, it's not like we hit 20 years, like, 20 years, it's done, right? Friendship, it's complete. No, friendship seems like it's just sort of open to go on forever. Of course, it might end at any moment. Me and my friend could be playing chess, and eventually we might stop because I have to go to bed. But of course, there's no part of playing chess that we know when it ends. It is part of playing a game of chess that we know when it ends. If you don't know when a game of chess ends, you're not playing chess at that point. So we have one activity that can be described in these two different ways. And it seems clear with this distinction in mind that the first thing we can say about a solution to our problem is that a meaningful life had better be organized around energeia as opposed to kinetic activities. We can see this in two ways. To start, there's an explanatory asymmetry between the two. So if I'm playing chess, I might play a game of chess in order to play chess. It makes total sense if you're doing an energeic activity to do something kinetic as a way to do that thing. If I'm just going on a walk, I might cross the street as part of going on this walk. But I can't do the reverse. If I'm doing a kinetic activity, something energeic cannot be a means to that end. We can even try to imagine like a best case scenario, right? You have a scavenger hunt. And one of the things on that scavenger hunt is something sort of fundamentally energeic, like live a happy life. And so you're like, oh, this is going to be hard. But you like, you know, find someone, you fall in love and get married and have kids and, you know, raise them up and they go off to college. And then, you know, you're like, oh, this has been a happy life. You're done, right? And then you sort of check it off. And because you only do it for the scavenger hunt, right, it's now come to an end. But of course, if that's true, you weren't trying to have a happy life in the energeic sense. You were trying to have had a happy life to get to some completion point where it's been done. But that itself will be a kinetic description of what is properly speaking an energeic activity. And so if our life is characterized by both of these things, then it had better be the case that the top level is an energeic one, because otherwise there can't be a unity to our life. Because if our utmost activity is a kinetic one, that can't be integrated in with the energeia. Another way to make this point is that living a life organized around kinesis tends to open you up to a certain type of crisis of meaning. There's a really interesting book by this philosopher Kieran Setti about the midlife crisis, in which he argues that when most people undergo a midlife crisis, it's precisely because the understanding of the meaning of their life has been dominated exclusively or too much by kinesis, by things that they want to have had done. Because you eventually reach a point where a lot of the things you will have done, you've already done, and the remaining things you want to have done, you're probably never going to do. So you've gotten married, you have your kids, you've made partner at the law firm, and you're probably not going to win the Nobel Prize. And at this point, it's unclear what you're going to do because your life doesn't seem to have meaning anymore because the kinetic activities that underlit it are either complete or likely not going to get completed. In contrast, we can take all these same activities and swap them to energeia, and it's clear you're not going to have the same sort of risk. So we can imagine a parent, you know, the sort of really competitive dad who they really want to raise their kids well and get them off to a good college. And they raise their kids and get them off to a good college, and now they just kind of feel listless and not sure what they're supposed to do with their time. Because they understood what they were doing here as trying to have done something which they've now done. But of course, you could also be after an ongoing relationship with your children, something fundamentally energeic. And of course, there'll be a transition what that looks like before your kid goes off to college and after. But it doesn't mean that your like purpose or meaning in life has now come to an end. Because, of course, the energeic activities don't come to an end in this way. So if this is right, then if we're going to want a solution to our play-work problem, It's going to have to be found in some sort of activity that's energeic in character, which is going to resist the dilemma we've identified before of either being frivolous like play or being, you know, ultimately kind of dependent on bad things like work. So let's take quick stock. We first introduce a puzzle of meaning that arises when we organize our activities as all either work or play. We've now suggested another way to organize activities, kinesis and energeia, and have suggested if we have a solution to our first problem, it's going to be by appeal to energeia. This is also promising for overall project of understanding why Aristotle puts friendship and contemplation so high up. Because one thing that's clear, friendship is energeic in this way. Friendship doesn't have a completion point. And contemplation is energeic in this way. Right? This is the distinction between contemplation, right, where you like are contemplating a piece of art or thinking through a mathematical proof you understand, and discovery, where once you've discovered something, it's discovered. Right? Discovery is an intellectual operation that is kinetic in character, whereas contemplation is an intellectual operation that's energeic in character. So we at least should feel like we're on the right track for understanding what's going on with Aristotle, because the two things that were mysterious to us will at least have the sort of character of the thing we're now looking to try to understand. But we don't yet have a solution. Because energeia, it might seem, sort of just resembles play. All the things you described, right, seem to have, like, it's just for the sake of the activity itself. But of course, doesn't that mean we have the same sort of frivolity if it's only the value of that activity? And we're trying to get outside of ourselves in some sense? So we need a second distinction. A distinction between two distinctions. I'm taking this way of putting it from a great article by Christine Korsgaard, who's a philosopher at Harvard, called Two Distinctions in Goodness. But the point is one that is recognizably Aristotelian, I believe. And she says, look, Korsgaard says we can distinguish two ways in which we can see things as good. One is the distinction between something being finally good, an end in itself, and being instrumentally good. You want it only because it gets you something else. Money is a classic example of something that's just instrumentally good. You value money just because you can get something else with it. Things like pleasure seem to be finally good, right? You don't want pleasure so you can do something else. You just want the pleasure itself. But there's a second distinction. A distinction between intrinsic good, which is something which is good in its own right, and something that's extrinsically good, which is good, but its goodness is referred to the goodness of something else. So to take an example here, suppose, you know, my grandfather died and left me this, you know, pocket watch. Pocket watch is, you know, as far as like if I bought it to like a pawn shop, it would be like a dollar or two, right? It's not nice in any sort of classical sense. It has basically no instrumental value. But I might really value it. But of course, I only value it because I value my grandfather. I don't value it as a means to my grandfather. I don't even know what that would mean. It's not like I'm going to forget about my grandfather if I don't have his watch or something. But I value it because I value my grandfather. It's not a means to anything, so it's a final value, but it's a final extrinsic value. It has final extrinsic value to me. Because if I find out this actually wasn't my grandfather, it was some con man who tricked my family into paying his medical bills, you know, for the last 3 years of his life, I'm not going to attach the same value to the pocket watch anymore. Which shows it wasn't anything about the pocket watch that I valued, it was my grandfather I valued, and still I value my pocket watch in light of that. And this is true for lots of things that have final value, like pleasure. So we value pleasure, but it does seem like we generally value pleasure because we value the thing we take pleasure in. You know, I'm a dad, and if my, you know, one of my kids were to be kidnapped and tortured, and I was forced to watch, it'd be horrible, a horrible experience. But now suppose some, you know, crazed neuroscientist sticks electrodes into my brain, so I feel sort of euphoric waves of pleasure as I watch my child be tortured. That doesn't make the situation better. It makes it much worse. Because pleasure is not just something intrinsically good. Pleasure is something extrinsically good. Pleasure is good when taken in good things, but bad when taken in bad things. And so even though pleasure is not a means to an end, it still doesn't mean that it's just an intelligible end on its own right. The intelligibility of it seems to depend on valuing other things as well. And so what we can say here is we've got these four boxes on the handout. And we can say, look, the problem with trying to place value in work is that it's box D. It's just instrumentally valuable. So it has to have something else that explains that value. The problem with play is that it's all in box A, which is it's finally valuable, but it's all intrinsic to the activity itself, so you can't get any activity more so than the activity of the activity, so we're kind of stuck in the sort of whatever limited value the activity has. We can't look to box B, because of course nothing can be both intrinsically valuable and instrumentally valuable, because the whole point of instrumental value is it gets its value by getting something else. So if we want a solution, we need something that falls into box C. something like pleasure, something like that pocket watch, something which is valuable not as a means to an end, but that the value can still be referred to another thing. But of course, unlike pleasure and unlike the pocket watch, it has got to be energetic activity. So we've at least now sort of narrowed down to a fairly limited set of things that Aristotle is going to be able to point to that are going to solve this problem. What we need is an activity whose value can be referred externally to something greater beyond itself, but that remains finally valuable, not just instrumentally valuable to get you that other thing. And so the way Aristotle put this is we need something that rests in that value. We need something that's not trying to produce that value, preserve that value, but has the value and engages in it. Now, rest here does not mean what we often mean by rest, which is like a sort of inactivity or apathy or disconnectedness. Instead, it's a kind of active activity, but an activity that's not trying to bring about or produce the value, but simply resides in that value. And so we need a sort of energetic activity that can obtain with this sort of value. And now we have to know, well, what sort of value can it be? And Aristotle is going to think, so we need a sort of human activity that can rest in its proper object, kind of actively. Well, what are the proper objects of the rational activities for Aristotle? And here, this is really important Aristotelian doctrine, which I can talk more about in Q&A if people are interested. But Aristotle thinks we have practical reason and theoretical reason. Practical reason aims at the good. We do acts because we think there'll be a good life. Theoretical reason aims at the true. We think things because we think them true. So we need energetic activities that can rest in the proper objects of the good and the true. And for Aristotle, it turns out there are only two such activities. The first activity is contemplation. There are many different intellectual activities directed at truth. For instance, research or discovery is an activity about coming to know the truth. But of course, research and discovery, once you know that truth, there's nothing more to be done. Memorization is an activity at preserving the truth, keeping that truth that you have possession of. But of course, once it's secure, there's nothing more to be done. In this way, God never needs, if he's omniscient, to spend any time memorizing or discovering or researching. But when we say, therefore, that God is the least intellectual of all beings, that sounds wrong. And certainly it sounds wrong if you're invested in the Catholic intellectual tradition. And so there had better be some sort of activity that God can does, in some sense, that is still intellectual activity, even if it's not aimed at producing or securing or preserving truth. Instead, it's resting in the truth. And what is that activity? Well, Aristotle says that all that God does is he's thought thinking himself. God engages in contemplation for Aristotle. Because you can contemplate a truth that you already know without trying to bring it about. When you like really appreciate some mathematical proof or a beautiful work of art that you're trying to understand, you know, you understand it and you sort of appreciate it. This is why we read books that are great and that we understand, because we are sort of dwelling in those true things that they reveal to us. We're not trying to discover something new. Instead, we are actively resting in that truth that we already know. So Aristotle thinks we can contemplate the truth, which is not an act of discovery, but instead a resting in that, which is the sort of activity. And so here we have this one, contemplation, and we have a second one, which is friendship. Because what does Aristotle think the good is for human beings? Well, for Aristotle, the good of a human life is happiness, by which he means a life of activity in accordance with virtue. With, you know, some complications here, right? But an activity directed by reason in accordance with virtue. Now, here's the problem. If you're just a virtuous person alone, you can't rest in that virtuous activity. You can't rest in your own courage. Because, of course, if there's nothing to do, there's no courageous activity to rest in. You can engage in courageous activity if there's a child in a burning building, because you can rush in and save the child. But if there's no child in the burning building, if all the work has been done, there's no work for your courage left to do, it seems. And so how are we supposed to rest in the goodness of a human life, the goodness of a virtuous human life? For Aristotle, we do this through friendship. Because the best friendship is a friendship of virtue, a friendship we make with people who are virtuous. And we make friends with people who are virtuous rather than someone else because they live good lives, because they are good people, because there is something good about them. And so in this, Aristotle thinks, friendship is the way in which we can rest in the good of a human life, as opposed to try to actively produce the good of a human life. And we can do so in a way that doesn't rely on there, for instance, being famines and disasters and things of this sort. And so this gives us an answer to both of our questions. Friendship and contemplation are special because they're the only activities that allow rational faculties to fully rest in their objects. Only in friendship can we rest in the good of a virtuous human life. And only in contemplation can we rest in truth. It also answers our second question of why were there two activities? Because for Aristotle, there are only two rational types of activities, theoretical reason and practical reason. Or to use a more scholastic medieval notion, there are only two rational faculties, the intellect and the will. And so because those things have two, there can only be these two chief activities. Now, this is, of course, a lecture for the Thomistic Institute, so we should probably say something here about Thomas Aquinas. Now, Aquinas, like Aristotle, accords a central place to both friendship and contemplation. Those of you who know your Aquinas will know that for Aquinas, our ultimate happiness is found in the beatific vision, which is for him direct contemplation of the divine essence. Our ultimate happiness is the contemplation of God. And how is it that we can contemplate God? Aquinas says our fullest contemplation of God is mediated by our charity. The more charitable we are, the greater we can contemplate God. And what does Aquinas define charity as? As friendship with God. So for Aquinas, our ultimate beatitude is the contemplation of God mediated by our friendship with God. Here we see, once again, for Aquinas, there are two central components to the happiness of a human life, the contemplation and friendship of God in eternity. We once again see Aristotle's unique two activities placed above everything else. But with this important difference. For both Aristotle and Aquinas, the higher the thing that you're joined to in this energeic rest, the better is the activity. So if you're friends with a dog, that is a less good thing. It's a less wonderful thing than being friends with a human. And to be friends with a bad human is a less wonderful thing than to be friends with a great human or a saint. To be friends with a saint has a much more transformative and wonderful, you know, effect on your life. Now, Aristotle thinks, what is the greatest thing? God. Aristotle thinks this, you know, his God isn't actually God. His God is, you know, thought thinking itself, whatever that means. But he does think that the best thing we can do is contemplate, because we can contemplate God. But he says that for this very reason, contemplation is better than friendship, because Aristotle famously says, you can't be friends with God. Friendship with God is impossible. And therefore, Aristotle says that theoria, or the intellect, is higher than practical reason of the will. That it is better to know and understand than it is to love and to act. Because Aristotle thinks it's only the intellectual activity that can be joined to the highest of all possible objects. Friendship is limited to the goodness of human beings, whereas the intellect can be joined to the goodness of God. And this is, I think, one of the most profound changes that Christianity makes to the Aristotelian system. Because it holds out the hope that we can not only contemplate God, but be friends with him. And so not only our intellects, but also our wills can be joined to the highest possible object. And so for Aristotle, he has to say that the life of the philosopher is better than the life of love. He has to say, in other words, that Thomas Aquinas was better than St. Francis. But Aquinas doesn't have to say that, precisely because Aquinas has the resources to say that we can also be friends with God. Which brings me back to the thesis I started with, that Aristotle needed to get a life.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith. And it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.